Hill Rail track only ran east to west, but extensions were planned back in the 1920s. I suppose I shouldn't be surprised to find one here. For what else would commend this extremely boring 60s office block to the laundry as a temporary headquarters? I look at Handcart Man. "Can I ride this?" I ask. Instead of answering, he pulls a second lever. I shrug. You'd think I'd have learned better than to ask zombies complex questions by now, wouldn't you? The rumbling builds to a loud roar, and a remarkable object rolls out of the tunnel and screeches to a halt in the middle of the room. It's a train, of course. Three carriages, all motorized. But it's tiny. You could park it in my front hall. The roofs of the carriages barely rise waist-high, and they sport external handles. Handcart Man shambles to the front carriage and hinges the roof right up. Not even breaking a sweat, he begins to load the files from his cart into a storage bin. "Hey, what about..." I focus on the second carriage. It's got wire mesh sides and what looks like a bench. "Me?" Handcart Man lifts a box of files out of the front carriage, deposits it in his cart, and lowers the lid. Then he walks to the second carriage, lifts the roof, and looks at me expectantly. "I was afraid you were going to say that," I mutter, and climb in. The wooden bench seat is about 5 centimeters above the track bed, and I have to lean backward as he drops the lid with a clang. The carriage is only big enough for a single passenger. It smells musty and dry, as if something died in here a long time ago. Turning my head sideways, I watch as Handcart Man walks over to the big circuit breaker and yanks it down and up, down and up. It must be some kind of trackside signal, because a moment later I feel a motor vibrate under me, and the train starts to roll forward. I make myself lie down. It'd be a really great start to the mission to scrape my face off on the tunnel roof. And a moment later I'm off, rattling feet first into the darkness under London, on a false flag mission. At about the same time I'm falling feet first into a piece of railway history, another part of the plot is unfolding. Let me try to reconstruct it for you. A red-haired woman holding a violin case is making her way along a busy high street in London. Wearing understated trousers and a slightly dated Issey Miyake top, sensible shoes and a leather bag that's showing its age, she could be a college lecturer or a musician on her way to practice. Without the interview suit, nobody's going to mistake her for an auction house employee or a civil servant, which shows how deceptive appearances can be. Kids and shoppers and office workers in suits and shop staff in uniforms move around her. She threads her way between them, not looking in shop windows or diverting her attention from the destination in hand. Here's a side street, and she turns the corner wide, avoiding a baby buggy, its owner nattering on her mobile, and strides along it before turning into another, wider street, at a corner where a bland 70s office rises 6 stories above the pavement. The office has glass doors and a reception desk, fronting an austere atrium. A bank of lifts behind it promises a rapid ascent into crowded beige cubicle heaven. The woman approaches reception and holds up an ID card of some sort. The guard nods, signs her in, then waves her onto the lift bank on the right. She could be a session musician turning up at one of the TV production companies listed on the wall panel beside the reception desk, or a member of staff on her way back from a lunchtime lesson. But she's not. The lift control panel shows 5 numbered floors. As the door slides closed, the woman pushes the 3rd floor button, then 1st floor, twice, then the 4th floor. The lift begins to move. The illuminated floor display tracks it up from ground to 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and it goes out. Then, safely stranded between indicated floors, the doors open. There are no cubicles here, only rooms with frosted glass doors that lock shut, and red security lights to warn against intrusion. Some of the rooms are offices, and some of them are laboratories, although the experiments that are conducted in them require little equipment more exotic than desktop computers and hand-wired electronic circuitry. The red-haired woman makes her way through the building with ease born of familiarity, until she finds room 505. She knocks on the door.
"Come in,"
the occupant calls, his voice muffled somewhat by the wood. Mo opens the door wide.
"Dr. Mike,"
she says, smiling.
Mo?
He has a large head for his average-sized torso, brown hair fighting a hard-bitten retreat, bound in a ponytail. His eyebrows, owlishly peaked, rise quizzically at her approach.
Good to see you.
It's been too long. She walks in and they embrace briefly. Are you busy?
Not immediately, no.
His desk tells a different story, piled high in untidy snowdrifts of paper. There's a laser printer on a table in one corner, and a heavy-duty shredder right below it, with a coffee mug balanced atop one particularly steep pile. The mug reads, "During off-hours, trains stop here." There's a bookcase beside the desk, crammed full of phrasebooks and travel guides, except for one shelf, which is occupied by a tiny Z-gauge model railway layout.
Were you passing through, or can I be of service in some way?
I was hoping to talk to you, she confesses. About... She shrugs. Mind if I sit down?
It's the cross-section growth coefficient, isn't it?
He asks, and one of his eyebrows tries to climb even farther.
Yes, yes, make yourself comfortable. Everyone has been asking about it this week.
He sighs, then backs towards his own chair, bearish on his short legs. I got an edited, probably garbled version of it from Andy last week, she explains. The original paper isn't on the intranet, so I thought I'd ask you about it. She nods at the door. In person.
Yes. Very wise.
His expression relaxes moment by moment. The scholars of night have been busy.
Word leaked.
Saturnine, he rests one hand on a graph-ruled notepad.
Or so I gather from Angleton.
That's interesting. Mo rests her violin against the side of her chair and crosses her legs. He's missing too, you know.
That's very interesting.
Now Ford's expression lightens.
The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things.
Mo nods. Footwear and naval architecture I know, but I never could get my head around why you'd put wax in the ceiling. Some kind of late...